She paused, while looking out at nothing.
You know, I'm sure you do. There are a few roof sections no one can achieve alone. Would you like to team up?
He made a tentative but negative gesture of his head. She lowered herself and was gone. The following summer in London, he kept in shape by scaling city buildings at night, including the recently built expansions to Selfridges. Someone had charted the emergency exits while the building had been going up, so he was there in rainstorms as well as clear weather.
Marsh Fellon,
the woman's voice said, as if she had just recognized him, though he was, in fact, hanging on to a slowly loosening gutter with one hand. Wait a minute.
All right. It's Ruth Howard, by the way.
I know. I saw you a few nights ago on the East Wall, above Duke Street.
Let's go for a drink, she said.
At the Stork, she told him about other good climbs she knew of in the city. A few Catholic churches and Adelaide House along the river were, she said, the most enjoyable. She told him more about Winthrop Young, as his roof climber's guide was almost a New Testament to her.
He wasn't just a climber. He won the Chancellor's Medal for English Verse, and he joined the Friends Ambulance Unit as a conscientious objector in the Great War. My parents lived near him and knew him. He's a hero to me.
Are you a conscientious objector? He asked.
No.
Why?
It's complicated.
Were you ever a student at Trinity? He asked her later.
Not really. I was looking for the right type of people.
Who did you find?
Someone I followed and picked up on the slopes of Selfridges. He bought me a drink.
Fellon found himself blushing. Because I caught your brother?
Because you told no one about it.
Am I the type, then?
I'm not sure yet. Let you know when I know. How did you fall?
I never fall.
You have a slight limp.
It was the boy in me that fell.
Even worse. Means it's more permanent. The fear. You come from Suffolk.
He nodded. Fellon had given up guessing how and what she knew about him.
When you fell, why did you fall?
We were Thatchers.
Quaint.
He said nothing.
I mean, it's romantic.
I broke my hip.
Quaint,
she said again, making a joke out of herself. Then,
we need someone there on the East Coast, by the way, near where you used to live.
In what way? He was prepared for her to say almost anything.
To keep an eye on certain people. We finished one war, but there's probably another coming.
He studied maps she had given him of the East Coast, all the small paths between its coastal towns, from Covehithe to Dunwich, and then the more detailed maps of farms belonging to people on her list. They had done nothing wrong, were only suspect.
We need to keep an eye on them in case of an invasion, she'd said. Their sympathies lie with Germany. You could slip in, leave no trace, hit and run, as Lawrence calls it. And that tool, what is it called?
A long flu knife.
Yes, good name.
He never saw the woman named Ruth Howard again, though he came across her name many years later in a confidential government report about the continuing, unforgiving turbulence in Europe, on a note attached to someone's angry scrawl.
We find ourselves in a collage in which nothing has moved into the past and no wounds have healed with time. in which everything is present, open and bitter, in which everything coexists contiguously.
It was a fierce note. Still, Ruth Howard had been his introduction to secret wars. She taught him the lost roof technique on the heights of Trinity, a phrase, she said, borrowed from Japanese art, where a high perspective, as from a belfry or cloister roof, allows you to see over walls into usually hidden distances, as if into other lives and countries, to discover what might be occurring there, a lateral awareness allowed by height. And Ruth Howard was correct. He was a secretive. Few would know how or where Felon participated in the various conflicts that would smolder through the next decades. Wildfowling. Marsh drove up to Whitepaint in the dark, and he and the dog watched Rose walk towards the dimmed light of the car and climb into the back seat. Felon reversed, then aimed the car towards the coast. He drove for almost an hour. She was asleep against the liver-coloured dog. Now and then he looked at them. His dog, the 14-year-old girl. At the estuary, he let the animal out and set up the camouflage blind. He carried the guns in their hard oilcloth cases from the boot of the car back to where the dog stood, already poised as if stretching towards something out there over the muddy, waterless estuary. It was that same unrecorded hour, almost non-existent, that Marsh Felon was always fond of, with the tide beginning to come in, inch deep at first. He could hear it in the dark. The only capsule of light anywhere was in the shell of the car where the girl was asleep, a door left open so the amber could be a marker, a compass point. He waited about an hour for the tide to enter and fill the estuary, then went back and held Rose's shoulder till she wakened. She stretched, pushing her arms against the felt of the roof, then sat for a moment, looking out into the dark. Where were they? Where was Felon's dog? He led her through the thick grass to the shoreline, the passing of time still being signalled by the growing depth of water. As light came up, it was a foot deep, the landscape almost recognisable. Suddenly, everything was awake. The birds were moving out from their nests. The gun dog, formal on the edge of the now 2-foot-deep estuary, was moving backwards as the water rose, swirling fast. It would be dangerous to a stranger who was not a strong swimmer. He would be pulled away, even by this shallow tide, whereas earlier he could have walked waist-deep across the 100-yard stretch of the Blythe estuary to that small temporary island. Felon fired, and the empty cartridge bucked free of the shotgun. The bird's silent fall down into the water. The dog swam out, tussled with it a moment, circled and swam back with the fowl. She noticed how the dog had grabbed it by its feet so he could breathe as he swam. Birds flew over him in chaotic sixes, and Felon fired again, clearer light now. He picked up the other shotgun, explained how to break it open and double load it. He didn't show her. He explained it, speaking quietly, watching her face's response for what she was actually taking in. He always liked and trusted how she listened, even when younger, her head lifted, watching his mouth. Dogs did that. She fired into the sky at nothing. He made her keep doing that to get used to the sound and recoil. Sometimes they drove to the Blythe estuary, sometimes to the Alder. After that first night journey, whenever Felon took her wildfowling along the tidal coasts, she climbed into the front seat and stayed awake, even if they barely spoke. She'd peer into the last darkness, the grey trees rushing at them, passing alongside as if uncaught. She was already thinking ahead, rehearsing how heavy the gun would be in her hands, the cold grip of it, the sweep of it up to the accurate height and moment, the recoil and echo of noise along the silence of the estuary. So she could become accustomed to all that, while the three of them journeyed towards it in the dark car. The dog leaned between the seats and placed his warm muzzle on her right shoulder, and she leaned over and pressed her own head against his. Rose's taut body and face barely changed over the years, kept a leanness. There was vigilance in her. Marsh Fellon could never tell where it came from, for the landscape she grew up in was placid, a self-sufficient place without urgency. Her father, the Admiral, reflected that placidness. He appeared unconcerned with what took place around him, but this was not the complete portrait of him. Marsh was aware that the father, just as he did, had a busier, more official life in the city. The two men accompanied each other on Sunday walks, with Marsh, always the amateur naturalist, speaking of the mystery of Chalk Hills, where whole faunas come and go, while the layers of the chalk are built from the efforts of infinitesimal creatures working in almost limitless time. Suffolk, for Rose's father, was such a slow, gradual universe, a plateau of rest. He knew the real and urgent world was the sea. Between the father and Fellon's easy friendship was the girl. Neither of the men seemed tyrannical or dangerous to her. Her father might appear a stuffed shirt when asked about political parties, but he let the family dog, Petunia, clamber onto the sofa and then into his arms. His wife and daughter watched such responses, well aware they did not exist for him at sea, where even a scuffed lanyard would be a punishable matter. And he was sentimental about music, would hush them when a specific melody came over the airwaves. When he was not there, his daughter missed that calm maleness that she could sidle next to for warmth when her mother's rules were restrictive. Which perhaps was why Rose, in his absence, sought out Marsh Fellon, listening to him open-mouthed about the insistent habits of hedgehogs, about a cow eating the afterbirth of its calf in order to renew its strength. She wanted the complex rules of adults and nature. Even in her youth, Fellon would always talk to her as an adult. When Marsh Fellon returned to Suffolk after long periods of time abroad, she would come to know him again. But she was no longer the young girl he had taught to fish or go wildfowling. She was married, with a daughter, my sister Rachel. Fellon watches Rose with the daughter tucked under her arm. She places Rachel on the grass and picks up the fishing rod, his gift. He knows her first response will be to test its weight, balance it on her fingers, then smile. He has been away too long. All he wants is to again catch that smile. She rubs her open palm against the grain of the impregnated rod, then picks up the infant and walks over to embrace Fellon, the child awkwardly between them. But he watches her now in an alternative way. She is no longer a learning youth, and it disappoints him. Whereas she, having driven up to her parents' home in Suffolk and seeing him again, does not imagine him as anything other than that ally from childhood. The sense of a difference between them is not in Rose, even if she is in the midst of constant breastfeeding, waking at 3 or 4 in the darkness. If she is thinking of anything somewhere in the back of her mind, it is not Fellon, her neighbor from the past, for whom she still has affection, but the career she had been moving towards that her marriage has now expelled from her life. She has a child, is already pregnant with another, so a career as a linguist appears lost. She is to remain a young mother. She feels less gymnastic. She even thinks of mentioning this to Fellon on their walk, when she is free of the child for an hour. It turns out that Felon is mostly in London, where she also lives with her husband in nearby Tulse Hill, but they do not run into each other. In London, they have separate lives. Felon works at the BBC, along with other projects he says little about. And although he is known as the lovable naturalist on his radio show, behind that portrait, he is known by some as a ladies' man, the boulevardier, her father keeps calling him. So this afternoon on her parents' lawn at Whitepaint is the first time she has seen him in years. Where has he been, she wonders. Still, it's now her birthday, and he has surprised her by arriving at her mother's lunch for her with this gift of a fishing rod. And as they meet, they promise to save each other an hour's walk alone. I have the blue-winged olive nymph you once made, she says. It feels like a confession. But she has become a stranger for him, that taut frame altered and tethered permanently to the child. She is less private, less vigilant. He does not know what it is exactly, but he feels she has given up what she was in some way. There was a pouncing manner in her he liked, which is no longer there. And then as she sweeps a cedar branch out of her way, he recognizes the faint line of bones at her neck that brings his affection back to what he thought was no longer there. So he proposes an idea of work to this brightest of women to whom he had once taught all manner of things. That list of the oldest rocks in the county in order of age, the best wood for an arrow, for a fishing rod. The wood she has just recognized by its smell as she held his gift to her face when he saw the thrill of her smile. Ash. He wants her in his world. He knows nothing about her adult life, that she was, for instance, hesitant and shy longer than was perhaps usual, till she stepped towards what she desired with a determination from which none could prize her away, a habit she will always have, that pattern of hesitancy at first, and then complete involvement, just as later on, in the coming years, nothing will draw her away from Felon, no logic of her husband, not even the responsibility of her two children. Is it Felon who chooses her, or is this something Rose always wished for? Do we eventually become what we are originally meant to be? It may not have been a path built by Marsh Felon at all. Perhaps such a life was what she always wanted, the journey she knew she would at some time leap towards. He buys and slowly rebuilds an abandoned cottage that makes him a distant neighbor to Whitepaint. But the small cottage stays mostly uninhabited, and when there, he is always alone. His role as host of the Naturalist's Hour on BBC Radio, which is heard on Saturday afternoons, displays perhaps his truest nature in those public soliloquies on newts, river currents, the seven possible names for a riverbank, the grailing flies made by Roger Woolley, the varying wingspans of the dragonfly. It is much the way he conversed with Rose whenever they crossed fields or riverbeds. Marsh Felon, as a boy, housed lizards in his fingers, swept up crickets with his palm and released them into the air. Childhood had been intimate and benign. That was him as he may originally have wished to be, the amateur lover of the natural world he entered whenever he could. But he is by now a secretive, with an unnamed position in a government office, and journeying into unstable zones of Europe, so there will be unknown stages in his story. Some theorize that what gives Felon skill in intelligence work derives from his knowledge of animal behavior. One person recalled Felon making him sit on the bank of a river while explaining warcraft as he fished. In these local rivers, It's the art of coaxing. Everything is a waiting game. And another time, as he cautiously dismantled an old wasp's nest, remarking, "You need to know not just how to enter a battle zone, but how to get out of it. Wars don't end. They never remain in the past. Seville to wound, Cordova to die in. That's the important lesson." Sometimes when he returns to the Saints, he catches sight of his family gathering reeds from the marshes, the way he had done as a boy. Two generations back, their grandfather had planted reeds along the river marshes, and now his heirs harvest it. There is still no pause within their conversations, but their loud words are now unshared with him, and he will not hear of their disappointments in a marriage or their pleasure in a new child. He had been closest to his mother. Being hard of hearing had been her defense against their endless talk, and when Marsh read a book, it was similar to that comfort of deafness. Now the brothers keep their distance from him, weaving together their own communal stories. For instance, about an anonymous thatcher on the coast, who took the name of Long Flew Knife, prepared, it was said, to kill German sympathizers in the event of an invasion. It was a country myth that spread in whispers. There had been a killing with such a blade, seemingly random. Some said part of a local row. From the height of a one-story roof, his brothers looked towards the coast and spoke of it. The name of a thatcher's tool suddenly known in every village. No. Marsh lost them long ago, even before he left the Saints. But how did he become what he became? This rural boy, curious about the distant world. How did he work his way into a war-skilled gentry? He had been a youth who at 12 could sail a lure and land it faultlessly on a river surface, then swing it across the current to drift towards the presence of a trout. At 16, he would change his unreadable handwriting to clearly record the design and tying of flies. He needed to be exact about this passion, cutting, sewing the camouflage of dry flies. It filled the silence of his days when he could make a grayling fly blindfolded, even with a high fever, even in high winds. By his mid-20s, he'd memorized the topography of the Balkan states, and had an expert knowledge of old maps where distant battles had been fought, now and then journeying to some of those innocent fields and valleys. He learned as much from those who barred the door to him as from those who let him in, gained a slow, informal knowledge of women, who were to him more like hesitant foxes he once had held briefly and endearingly in his arms as a boy. And by the time a war grew again in Europe, he had become a gatherer and sender-out of young men and women, luring them into silent political service. Because of what? Perhaps some small anarchy he glimpsed in them, an independence they needed to fulfill, and releasing them into the underworld of the new war. A group that eventually included, unknown to her parents, Rose Williams, the daughter of his neighbours in Suffolk. My mother. Night of the Bombers. On weekends, Rose drives up to Suffolk to visit her children who are living with her mother, safe from the blitz that is terrorising London. During one visit, on her second night there, they hear the bombers flying in from the North Sea. A long night. They have all established themselves in the living room of the darkened house, the children sleeping on the sofa, a mother, tired, kept awake by the noise of the planes, sitting by a fire. The house, the earth around it, does not stop shuddering, and Rose imagines all the small animals, voles, worms, even night owls and lighter birds in the air, caught in the avalanche of noise coming from the sky. Even fish in the rivers under the turbulence of water
because of the never-ending planes from Germany coursing low through the night. She realizes she is thinking the way Felon thinks. "I need to teach you how to protect yourself," he said once. He'd been watching her cast. "The way a fish, if he sees your line land, will work out where it comes from. He learns to protect himself." But Felon is not there this particular night of the bombers, while she and her mother and children are alone in the darkness of white paint, with only the face of the radio lit, which speaks quietly about parts of the city. Marylebone, sections of the embankment, that are already in ruins. A bomb has landed near Broadcasting House. There are unimaginable casualties. Her mother doesn't know where her father is. It is only the children, Rachel and Nathaniel, her mother and she, who are supposedly safe in this noisy countryside, waiting for the BBC to tell them something, anything. Her mother nods off, then is startled awake by more planes. They were speaking earlier about where Felon might be, and her father. Both somewhere in London. But Rose knows what her mother wants to talk about. As the planes quieten, she hears her say,
"Where is your husband?"
She says nothing. The planes recede into the darkness, heading west.
"Rose, I was asking. I don't know, for God's sake. He's overseas somewhere. Asia, is it?"
"Asia is a career, they say."
"You should never have married so young. You could have done anything after university. You fell in love with a uniform. As you did. And I thought he was brilliant. I didn't know then what he had been through. The brilliant are often destructive. Even Felon?" "No, not Marsh. He's brilliant. But he's also Marsh. He wasn't born into this world. He's the accident with, it seems, 100 careers. Thatcher, naturalist and authority on battle sites, and whatever else he is now."
There is again a weight of silence from her mother. Rose eventually stands up and goes to her, and in the firelight she sees her peacefully asleep. "Everyone has their own marriages," she thinks. After the recurring bouts of thunder from the planes, her children are asleep on the sofa, defenseless. Her mother's pale, fine hands are on the armrests of her chair. Northeast of them is Lowestoft. Southeast is Southwold. All along the coast, the army has buried mines on the beaches to protect against a land invasion. They have commandeered homes, stables, and outbuildings. At night, everyone disappears, and 500-pound bombs and high-explosive incendiaries whistle down on the sparsely populated houses and streets, so it seems as light as day. Families sleep in cellars, moving their furniture in with them. Most of the children have been evacuated away from the coast. The German planes returning to Europe will jettison their remaining bombs as they head back. So the only evidence of inhabitants comes after the sirens cease, and they gather on the front parade to gaze at the sky and watch the planes departing. Rachel struggles awake just before dawn. Rose takes her by the hand, and they walk out into the stilled fields, down to the river. Whatever route the bombers took, they have not come back this way. The water is flat, undamaged. They hold on to each other and walk along the bank in the dark, then sit, waiting for light. It is as if everything is hiding. "The important thing is I need to teach you to protect those you love." She still has some of Marsh's long-ago words in her. The morning gets warmer and she removes her sweater. Nothing moves in the shell-shocked water. Her bladder is full, but she keeps it that way as part of a prayer. If she does not crouch down, if she does not piss,
They will all be safe, in London as well as here. She wants somehow to participate, to control what is happening around her, in this time of unsafety. A fish, camouflaged in shadow, is no longer a fish, just a corner of landscape, as if it has another language, the way we need to be unknown sometimes. For instance, you know me as this person, but you don't know me as another person. Do you understand?
No, not quite.
And Fallon explained it to her again, glad she did not just say yes to him. An hour later, Rose walks with Rachel towards the faint outline of the house. She is trying to imagine Fallon's other lives. At times it feels he is more innocently himself, only when he has a creature in his arms or a parrot on his shoulder. His parrot, he has told her, repeats everything it hears, so he can say nothing of importance in its vicinity. She realizes it is this unknown and unspoken world she wants to participate in. Quiver. When people in the service who knew him spoke casually of Fallon in public places, any reference to an animal would do, and the range of creatures chosen to depict him often led to comic extremes. The New World porcupine, a diamondback snake, the madrigal weasel. Whatever came to mind at that moment was not important, being there only for camouflage. It was this range of creatures assigned to Fallon that suggested how unknowable he was. So he could be photographed in Vienna, having dinner at the Casanova Review Bar with a beautiful teenager and her parents, and, after sending his companions off in a taxi to their hotel, be elsewhere 2 hours later with a courier or a stranger. And if a few years later he was seen at that same Vienna bar with Rose, the same beautiful young woman, no longer a teenager, he was there not for the seemingly obvious reason, but for another purpose, as she was. They would slip from one language to another, depending on who was beside them, or who was noticed over the other's shoulder. They behaved as uncle and niece, without irony. It was believable, even to themselves. For he needed to release her often on her own into another role, undressing down to her nakedness into one disguise or another. She might be in a European city working with him, then return on leave to her two children. And after a time she would be with him again in another city, where allied and enemy agents stumbled across each other. But for him, their roles of uncle and niece were a decoy, not only for their work, which freed him to be with her, but to continue his growing obsession. His job as a gatherer meant finding talent in either the semi-criminal world or among specialists, such as a well-known zoologist who had spent most of his life in labs weighing the organs of fish and could thus be relied on to precisely construct a 2-ounce bomb in order to destroy a small obstacle. It was only with Rose, eating across from him at some roadside inn, or driving beside him from London towards Suffolk on the dark roads, her pale hands blonde under the speedometer as she lit a cigarette for him. It was only with her that the purpose of his work slid from him. He desired her. All those inches of her. Her mouth, her ear, the blue eyes, the quiver at her thigh, her skirt lifted and bunched. Was it to satisfy him? His hand wishing to be there. Everything left his mind but that tremor. The one thing he did not allow himself was to consider how he must appear to her. Normally he'd have assumed he could seduce a woman with his wisdom, character, whatever it was that might have drawn her to him in the first place, but not simply as a man. He felt old, Only his thoughtful eyes could swallow her without hesitation or consent. And she, my mother, what did she feel? And was it he or she who had persuaded the other into this adventure? I still don't know. I like to believe they entered this tremulous universe as teacher and student, for this was not just physical love and desire. It encompassed the neighboring skills and possibilities of their surrounding work, the knowledge of how to retreat if contact with the other was broken, where to hide a weapon in a train carriage so the other would know where it was, which bone to break in the hand or the face to make a person irrational in response. All of that, alongside his wish for a moment when she might awaken, as if there were Morse between them in the darkness, or the place she perhaps wished to be kissed. How she would turn onto her stomach. The whole dictionary of love, war, work, education, growing up, growing older. There's a walled city near Ravenna, Velen whispered, as if its location needed to remain secret. And inside the city, within its narrow streets, is a small 19th-century theatre, an intimate jewel that looks as if the rules of its construction were based only on the principles of miniatures. Someday we can visit it. He said this more than once, but they never went there. There were other mysteries he knew of. Escape routes out of Naples or from Sofia, the surrounding plains that three armies had camped in with 1,000 tents before the second siege of Vienna in 1683. There was a map he'd seen, made from memory, long after the siege. He explained how mapmakers were once hired, even by great artists such as Bruegel, to help choreograph their crowd scenes. And there were the remarkable libraries to see, such as the Bibliothèque Mazarine in Paris. One day we can stand within it. He tossed out the offer. It was a further mythical destination, she thought. What did she contain in comparison to all that experience? It was like the embrace of a giant. She felt raised a league or a fathom into the air in order to witness such knowledge. Even though married, even though a linguist skilled in argument, she felt she had no vista of importance, that she was no more than a girl threading a needle by candlelight. She had been surprised to discover Felon was secretive and complex, almost out of a gentlemanly or shy courtesy. He was better at response, while she was cleverer at intellect, which was why she was eventually put in charge of harvesting data on enemy maneuvers. As she'd once done on a small scale from a hotel roof, aided by that singular man known to me and my sister as the Moth. And in the fourth year of the war, herself began broadcasting over the airwaves into Europe. She who once listened to everything Felon said was no longer the pupil. She became more actively involved, parachuted into the Low Countries after another radio operator was killed, journeying to Sofia, Ankara, and other smaller outposts that cordoned off the Mediterranean or wherever uprisings occurred. Her radio signature, Viola, became known widely on the airwaves. My mother had found her way into the larger world, somewhat the way that young Thatcher had done. The Astral Plough. Long before I came to work at the archives, just after my mother's funeral, I had pulled that paperback from one of her shelves and discovered in it the hand-drawn map on 8x6-inch paper of what looked like a chalk hill with low gradient contour lines. For some reason, I had kept this drawing that had no place names. Years later, when I worked in the archives, I discovered that whatever needed to be written down or typed up had to be done so on both sides of that same quarto-sized paper stock, single-spaced. Every person in the service had to abide by this rule, from the interrogator, Buster Milmo, to a temporary secretary taking shorthand. It was a practice observed in almost every intelligence office, from Wormwood Scrubs, parts of which had once been used as an intelligence headquarters, and where as a boy I assumed my mother was entering to serve a prison term, to Bletchley Park. No other paper stock was allowed. I realized I had a map connected with intelligence, which had been kept by my mother. Our building housed a central map room where giant charts floated loosely in midair, so that they could be pulled down on a roller and gathered like landscapes into your arms. I would go there every day to eat a solitary lunch, sitting on the floor, the banners barely moving above me in that nearly windless room. For some reason, I was at ease there. Perhaps it was the memory of those distant lunches with Mr. Nkoma and the others, as we waited to receive his casually illicit stories. I went there with the drawing, after having it copied onto a transparency, and began projecting the slide onto various maps. It took 2 full days before I found its exact match, on a map whose altitude lines fitted neatly against my original drawing. What I now had, by linking the Chalk Hill drawing to its reality on a large, specifically named map, was a precise location, which was where I now knew my mother had once briefly been based, with a small unit sent in, as the report had stated, to loosen the linchpins of a post-war guerrilla group, where one of them was killed, and 2 of them were captured. The hand-drawn map suggested intimacy, and I was curious to discover whose intimacy it was, since the drawing, at one time useful, had been saved in a favorite Balzac paperback. My mother had thrown nearly everything else away from that period, when they were all doing God knows what, destroying the linchpins. In our warren, we had often come upon cases where the survivors of political violence had taken up the burden of vengeance, sometimes into the next generations. How old were they? I half remember my mother asking Arthur McCash the night of our kidnapping.
People behave disgracefully sometimes,
my mother had once said to me, when I and 3 boys in the 5th form were temporarily suspended from school for stealing books from Foyle's bookshop on Charing Cross Road. Now, these many years later, reading fragments of what clearly were silent political killings committed in other countries, I was appalled, not only by my mother's activities, but that she'd put my theft in a similar category. She'd been shocked at the stealing of books.
People behave disgracefully.
A mockery of herself, perhaps, along with her judgment of me. What did you do that was so terrible? My sins are various. One afternoon, a man knocked on my cubicle wall.
You speak Italian, don't you? Your file says so.
I nodded.
Come with me. The bilingual in Italian is ill today.
I followed him up a flight of stairs to a section occupied by those fluent in languages, aware that whatever the job was, his status was higher than mine. We entered a windowless room, and he handed me a heavy set of earphones.
Who is it?
I asked.
Doesn't matter. Just translate.
He switched on the machine. I listened to the Italian voice, at first forgetting to translate, until he waved his arms. It was a recording of an interrogation, a woman doing the questioning. The audio wasn't good. It seemed to have been done in something cave-like, full of echoes. Also, the man being questioned was not Italian, and wasn't being helpful. The recording kept being turned off, then switched on again, so there were gaps of time. The interrogation was clearly at an early stage. I had read and heard enough of these now to know they would knock the ground out from under the man later on. But now he was protecting himself by seeming uninterested. His answers wandered. He went on about cricket, complained about some inaccuracies in Wisden. They got him off the topic by asking him bluntly about a massacre of civilians near Trieste, and about the English involvement with Tito's partisans. I leaned forward, stopped the machine, and turned to the man beside me. Who is this? It would help to have a context. You don't need that. Just tell me what the Englishman is saying. He works with us. We need to know if anything important was revealed. When is... Early 46. The war is officially over, but... Where is it happening? It's a recording we captured after the war, from one of the remnants of Mussolini's puppet government. Mussolini already strung up, but some of his followers still around. It was found in an area outside Naples. He signaled me to put on the headphones and started the tape again. Gradually, after several time jumps in the tape, the Englishman began talking, but about women he'd met here and there, details about the bars they went to, what kind of clothes they wore, and if they had spent the night together. He was easy with the information, offering data that was obviously unimportant. The hour a train got into London, etc., etc. I turned the machine off. What's wrong? My colleague asked. It's useless information, I said. He's just talking about his affairs. If he's a political prisoner, he hasn't revealed anything political, only what he specifically likes about women. He doesn't seem to like crudeness. Who does? He's being clever. He's one of our best. This is stuff that interests only a wife or husband. He turned the tape back on. Then the Englishman was talking about a parrot that had been found in the Far East, which had lived for decades with a tribe that was now extinct, its whole vocabulary lost. But a zoo had the parrot, and it turned out the creature still knew the language. So the man and a linguist were attempting to recreate the language from that one bird. The man was obviously tiring, but kept talking, almost as if this way he could delay specific questions. He had been useless to the interrogators so far. The woman was clearly looking for someone. Identifications, place names they could link to a map, a town, a killing, the failure of an expected victory. But then he spoke about one woman's air of solitude, and, in another pointless aside, about a pattern of birthmarks on her upper arm and neck. And suddenly I realized this was something I had seen as a child and had slept against. And so it was that during my translation of a recorded interrogation that included descriptions of possibly invented women and parrot lore, all put forward by the captured man as useless information, I heard described the pattern of birthmarks on my mother's neck. I returned to my office, but the interrogation stayed with me. I half believed I had heard the man's voice before. I even thought for a while it might belong to my father. Who else would have known those distinguishing marks? The unusual cluster of moles, whose pattern, the man had joked, resembled a star formation called the astral plough. Each Friday, I boarded the 6 o'clock train at Liverpool Street Station and relaxed, just stared at the ribbon of landscape passing me. It was the hour of distilling everything I had gathered during the week. Facts, dates, my official and unofficial research fell away and were replaced by the gradual story, half-dreamed, of my mother and Marsh Fellon. How they had eventually walked towards each other without their families, their brief moment as lovers, and then their retreat, but still holding on to their unusual faithfulness to each other. I had barely a clue as to their cautious desire, of travels to and from dark airfields and harbours. All I had, in reality, was no more than a half-finished verse of an old ballad, rather than evidence. But I was a son, parentless, with what was not known to a parentless son, and I could only step into fragments of the story. It was the night driving home from Suffolk after her parents' funeral, the speedometer light on her dress, covering her knees. Damn. They had left in darkness. All afternoon she had watched him courteous at the grave, and at the reception listened as he spoke shyly and tenderly about her parents. Country neighbours she had known since childhood came up to her to give condolences and ask after the children who were at home in London. She had not wanted them at the funeral. She had to explain again and again that her husband was still overseas.
A safe return then, Rose.
And she would incline her head. Later she witnessed Felon struggling to move a full and overlapping punch bowl off a rickety table onto a more solid one, the guests' laughter loud beside him. For some reason, she'd never felt so relaxed. When everyone had gone, about 8 in the evening, she and Felon left for London. She did not want to stay in the empty house. They drove immediately into fog. They crept along for a few miles, stopping warily at every junction, and paused at a railway crossing for almost 5 minutes, because she thought she heard the howl of a train. If there was a train, it remained howling in the distance, as cautious as they were.
Marsh?
What?
Do you want me to take over?
The dress had moved as she turned to him. 3 hours to London. We could stop. She flicked on a small light.
I can drive. Ilkeshall. Where's that on the map?
Somewhere in this fog, I guess.
Okay, she said.
Okay, what?
Let's stop. I don't want to drive in this, after the way they died.
I know.
We can go back to white paint.
I'll show you my house. You've not seen it in a while.
Oh.
She shook her head, but was curious. He turned the car. It took 3 attempts on the narrow, fog-blind road, then drove to the cottage he had rebuilt long ago. Come. It was cold inside. Bracing, she would have said if it was morning, but it was pitch black, not a clue of light. He had no electricity, just a stove he cooked on, and that kept the place warm. He began burning wood in it. He dragged a mattress in from an unseen room. It was too far, he said, from the heat. All this he had done within 5 minutes of entering. She'd not said a word, was just watching Felon to see how far he would go. This always careful man, always careful with her. She was disbelieving about what was happening. There was already too much closeness in the room. She was used to being with Felon in open country.
I'm a married woman, Marsh.
You are nothing like a married woman.
And of course you know married women.
Yes, but he is in no way a part of your life.
It's been a long time since that.
You can sleep here by the fire. I don't have to. A long silence, her mind tumbling.
I think you might need to now.
Then I want to be able to see you. He went over to the fire, opened the flue, and it brightened their room. She lifted her head and watched him directly.
You too, then?
No. I am not interesting. She saw herself lit only by the stove's flickering light, with the long sleeves of the dress she'd worn at the funeral.
It felt strange. Something had slid under her reason. And also that this was a night of fog, with the world around them invisible, anonymous. She woke, enveloped, his open palm under her neck.
Where am I?
This is where you are.
Yes. It seems this is where I am. Unexpected.
She slept and woke again.
What is it about funerals?
She asked, her head against his body. It would be cold, she knew, beyond the fire's reach.
I loved them, he said. Just like you. I don't think that's it. I mean, to sleep with their daughter. And after their funeral.
You believe they are rolling in their graves?
Yes. Besides, now what? I know about your women. My father called you a boulevardier.
Your father was a gossip.
I think, after tonight, I'm going to stay away from you. You're too important to me.
Even in this distilled, cautious version of Felon and Rose, there is a confusion and even uncertainty about what may have happened, what may have been said. Nothing quite fits within the rhyme of their story. Who was it, or what, exactly, would break off the relationship that began that night by an iron stove? She had not been a lover as she had been this night for a long time. What would it be like for him, she wondered, to leave her after this? Would it be like one of his historical anecdotes, where a small army departed a Carolingian border town with courtesy and silence, or would everything around them clatter with repercussions? She would need to leave him before that happened. Leave a pawn blocking the river bridge, so neither she nor he could cross it anymore. To make clear it was an ending after this sudden and remarkable glimpse of the other. It needed to still be her life. She turned to face Felon. She rarely called him Marsh. It was almost always Felon. But she loved the name Marsh. It sounded as if he went on and was difficult to cross, to fully understand, that she would get her feet wet, that burrs and mud would attach themselves to her. I think it was then, after their night by the stove, that she decided to return safely to who she still was, and remain separate from him, as if suffering was always a part of desire. She couldn't let her guard down with him. She would wait, however, a bit longer for full light, when the joyous lover he had been would once again become unknown to her, a mystery. At dawn, she heard a cricket. It was September. She would remember September. There is a moment during Felon's questioning by the Italian woman, when the interrogators swivel away the bright light that is blinding him, and it flares briefly past her face, and he, always so damn quick to pick up what occurs around him, sees her clearly. He has, as someone said, those strangely inattentive eyes that miss nothing. And he notices the smallpox marks on her skin, and judges her instantly as no beauty. Do they intentionally make him aware of the woman questioning him? Can they tell that he is a sensualist? That he can be teased into a petite flirtation? And the brief revelation of the woman, what does that do to him? What is his response? Does it moderate his flirtation? Is he gentler or more confident? And if they know that much about him, enough to place a woman on the other side of the arc light, hidden in the dark, is that movement of the light accidental or intentional?
Historical studies inevitably omit the place of the accidental in life, we are told. But Felon, in fact, is always open to casual accidents.